welcome to Animal Voices on Co-op Radio 102.7 FM. It is September 3rd, 2010, and I'm your co-host, Joanne Chang, here in the studio with Carissa Thorpe. In the controls is Allison Cole, and supervising the controls is John Pranger. Today on the show, we're going to have Jack Norris, vegan dietitian, to come to speak to us about vegan nutrition. And we'll also be talking to Sheila Beggs from Huggable, which is a local pit bull organization, and she will be talking to us about one of the misunderstood breeds of dogs. And also Carissa is going to share with us her thoughts on traveling with dogs in the back of your truck. And for right now, I think Allison has the events for us.
Yeah, I do have our upcoming events. On Friday, September the 10th at 6:30 p.m., there will be a vegetarian dine-out at Akali Singh Sikh Temple organized by Earth Save Canada. This happens at the temple at 1890 Skeena Street in Vancouver. This event will include a tour of the Akali Singh Sikh Temple, a talk about the Sikh religion, and a full dinner and dessert. This is a fundraising dinner with all proceeds going to the nonprofit organization Earth Save Canada. The price is all-inclusive, which is only $10 per person. The dinner will include subji, which is a mixed vegetable dish, dal, which is a lentil dish, as well as a rice dish and other vegetarian dishes. All dishes will be well-seasoned, flavorful Indian dishes, but not too hot and spicy. There are usually lots of fresh fruits and vegetables. To RSVP and register for this event, please visit meetup.com and search for Vancouver Meatless Meetup. All are welcome to attend. On Sunday, September the 12th at 6 o'clock p.m. there will be a memorial ceremony for all who have lost a beloved pet in any manner. This will take place at the south end of Trout Lake in East Vancouver. If you would like to attend, you can meet by the Beach House bulletin board. At this ceremony, participants will name the pets they have lost and do a visualization of them in a happy place, plus some singing. Please bring tea lights, lanterns, photos, and other mementos of beloved pets you have lost. Anyone 14 years old and over is welcome to attend. The cost is a suggested donation of $10, which goes to Horse Protection Canada, which is a grassroots organization dedicated to ending horse slaughter. And you can also download a petition from their website, which they are sending to Parliament to end horse slaughter, and you can get those at horseprotection.info, and there's more information there about the pet memorial ceremony. And finally, ongoing every Monday, there's a fundraising event for Katka Campaigns Against the Cruelty to Animals, which is called Bowl for the Animals. This happens at the Excalibur Bowling Center at 12350 Petullo Place in Surrey. Have fun bowling and eating veggie and vegan food while helping the animals in need. Bowling for the Animals is here and happening every Monday. Just get a group of 3 to 6 or more friends and come for a bowling evening of afternoon of fun. The Katka fundraiser package is $20 per person and includes 2 games of bowling, bowling shoes, and for vegans, just bring some non-slippery shoes, a veggie and vegan burger or wrap with salad or french fries, and a glass of pop iced tea or beer. The price includes taxes and gratuities. Just go on a Monday to Excalibur Bowling Center, and at the reception, just say that you're there for the Katka fundraising to get this special promotional price. If you have an animal or vegetarian-related event coming up that you would like to have announced on the show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, which is called Animal Voices Vancouver.
And on to you, Carissa. What do you have to share with us about traveling with dogs in the back of your truck?
All right. Recently, I got into a heated debate with 3 guys when we passed an unrestrained dog in the back of a pickup on the Sea to Sky Highway, who was walking back and forth in the box of the truck, and he was looking all around him. I made some comment that was more to myself than to anyone else about how that was sad, and everyone interjected that I don't know what I'm talking about, and this is how dogs are meant to be, and that the dog was living the life and having a great time.
Oh, there's a bylaw against that, yeah. So you could have reported that person's license plate.
And while to some dogs and trucks might seem to make a lot of sense, particularly in smaller communities where the practice of dogs in the back of a pickup is a common sight, the case is not so. The truth of the matter is that unsecured dogs in the back of a truck or other vehicle pose dangers not only to the dogs but also to humans. If a dog jumps, falls, or is thrown from a moving vehicle, he or she could sustain serious or deadly injuries and could potentially cause a collision with other motorists. The consequences, in addition to the loss of a beloved companion, could be hefty veterinary bills or financial responsibility in the event of a motor vehicle accident. Proper restraint is not only essential and life-saving, but it's also the law under the Motor Vehicle Act of British Columbia, which states in Section 72 with regards to the transportation of animals that a person commits an offense if the person transports a living animal on the running board, fender, hood, or other exterior part of a motor vehicle unless a suitable cage, carrier, or guardrail is provided and is attached adequately to protect that animal from falling or being thrown from the vehicle. Fines start at $109 in British Columbia. The BCSPCA website highlights the necessity of proper restraint, stating that dogs restrained with loose ropes or ties can accidentally hang themselves. Additionally, animals exposed to the elements could potentially suffer heat stroke or hypothermia, depending on the weather conditions at the time. And if your pet is injured while traveling in your vehicle, you can be charged with cruelty to animals under the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act. Unrestrained animals are distractions to drivers, both yourself and other motorists, which can cause vehicle collisions. Also important to note is that in the event of a car crash, pets become flying objects and have the potential to cause injury to both themselves and others. According to the BCSPCA website, a pet weighing 50 pounds and traveling at 50 kilometers per hour weighs approximately 1 ton upon impact. Mm. The best solution is to take your dog inside the vehicle with you and employ the use of a dog seat belt or secured crate, or if the dog must be in the box of the truck, the safest thing to do is to put him or her in a crate secured in the middle of the box against the cab, and the very least of all precautions should be to tether your dog using a dog seat belt in the back of the box. There's little doubt that motorists who are transporting their dogs in such a dangerous way love their animals, as the fact they're taking the dog with them proves, but education and proper forethought are the keys to avoiding needless tragedies. Many people view their animals like children, yet surely you'd be hard-pressed to find so many people willing to endanger their children's lives the way many do their pets. You're listening to the Animal Voices radio show on 102.7 FM, CFRO in Vancouver, BC.
Thank you so much for that, Carissa. I see people do that once in a while in Vancouver. Usually they come from like Abbotsford or something, yeah. You know, they have the big trucks and the dog. And one time I rolled down my window, it was in the middle of the winter, and I said to this woman, I'm like, hey, you got your dog in the back of the truck. She's like, so who cares? And I said, well, it's against the law. And she's just like waving me off. And I said, I got your license plate. And then she started apologizing. She said, oh, geez, I didn't know there was a law against it. So it's good to call on the police or the SPCA.
I definitely would have called the police if she hadn't said anything in that instance.
The SPCA.
Is that the actual place to call?
Well, you know what? I don't think they ever do anything. I every time I call them, I just leave a message, and I don't think anything ever gets followed up on.
I would call the non-emergency police number.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do next time.
Yeah.
SPCA doesn't seem to respond. So do we have our next caller on the line? Great.
We sure do.
So one of our listeners, Alice Fedorenko, I think she's listening today. I hope she is. She called me up this week to ask some very good questions regarding protein and B12 in a vegan diet. And since I'm not really qualified to respond to her questions, I got in touch with one of the most knowledgeable vegan nutritionists around. Jack Norris is a registered dietitian and the first vegan to publicly warn about the dangers of B12 deficiencies in vegans. And besides his profession as a dietitian, Jack is also one of the founders of Vegan Outreach, a U.S.-based nonprofit animal rights organization. We're very thrilled to have him join us today to give us the lowdown on vegan nutrition. Hi, Jack. Welcome to Animal Voices.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Hey, so tell us about B12. Is it that difficult for vegans to obtain?
No, it's not difficult for vegans to obtain B12, but you have to make an effort to actually do it. There are, in some cases, people might just inadvertently get vitamin B12 through fortified soy milk or other fortified foods, but it is possible for someone who is not paying attention to their B12 intake to not eat any foods like that or not take any multivitamins, and therefore not get vitamin B12. So it's something vegans definitely need to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. And I was just going to say that, you know, yesterday, I'm one of those bad vegans who don't really pay much attention. But so just as an experiment, I decided to look at my B12 intake yesterday. And to my surprise, I took in 145% of my requirement yesterday just by eating almond milk, Yves vegan pepperoni, and Gardein vegan buffalo wings. So am I really getting adequate intake of reliable B12 from eating fortified foods?
Yeah, yes, you should be getting it from the fortified foods, so that's fine. I think you might be somewhat unusual in that you just happen to eat foods fortified with B12. I don't know that your average vegan is going to eat that much B12 accidentally.
Huh. Okay.
But in your case, that should be fine, as long as you consistently eat those foods, you know, each day.
Right.
Or similar foods that are fortified.
In cases where you've seen vegans with B12 deficiencies, what sort of foods were they consuming?
Well, it's all sorts of different types of diets. Mm-hmm. People can be either a completely whole foods vegan, where they don't eat any processed foods, and so they're very unlikely to get any foods that are fortified with B12. Or they can be not a whole foods vegan at all, but still not choosing the foods that are fortified. So it's mostly soy milks that are fortified with B12 these days. And as you pointed out, a few of the meat substitutes. And that's basically it. Now, there are some companies that fortify cereals. And so if you eat commercial cereal, I guess mainstream commercial cereals off a regular grocery store, you'll get B12 that way. Not many cereals and natural food stores fortify with B12. So it really depends on your diet. And I think it's easiest for vegans to get it through just a reliable B12 supplement that they take.
So it's not like it's hard to get. You just need to pay attention to it, pretty much.
Right. You just need to make sure you're doing it.
So what are some of the early symptoms of B12 deficiency?
The traditional ones are tingling in your fingers and toes, and then that, if you don't take care of it, it will progress up towards the center of your body, so to your arms and legs. And the other one is just simply fatigue, and also digestive problems can be a sign of B12 deficiency, especially if it's combined with fatigue. So those are the main things. But generally, you can't tell that you're getting enough B12 or not by whether you have symptoms, because there's two sides to B12 deficiency. One is what I have coined overt B12 deficiency, where it is obvious and you're having real physical symptoms. Mm-hmm. But the other type of B12 deficiency is mild deficiency, where your homocysteine levels are higher than they should be. And homocysteine is a acid in the blood, and it is thought to be toxic to nerves and blood vessels. And vegans who do not supplement with B12 usually have homocysteine levels that are very high compared to the rest of the population. And so it's something that has been a concern. And that's when we really, in the vegan community, started to warn people about vitamin B12. Is back in the year 2000 and 2001, a lot of studies started coming out showing that vegans had elevated levels of homocysteine.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something you can't tell. And the problem with it is that it eventually could lead to cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
So it's something not to mess around with.
Mm-hmm. So would you suggest that it would be a good idea to get a test done once a year or something like that?
No, I don't think that's necessary. Okay. All you need to do is make sure you're getting a reliable source of B12. And there's a few ways to do it. One is to eat fortified foods every day. Another is to take a multivitamin. And the ideal amount in a multivitamin, in a daily multivitamin, would be 25 micrograms of vitamin B12.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can take a 2,000 microgram, you can take a 1,000 microgram B12 supplement twice a week. That's another way to get enough B12. So there's a few different options.
So like things like unwashed vegetables or spirulina or anything like that, or nutritional yeast, are those not reliable?
If nutritional yeast is fortified with 12, it is a reliable source for the most part. You have to keep it out of light because UV rays can damage B12.
Okay.
So you don't want it exposed, but generally fortified nutritional yeast is a good source. Let's see, another source, spirulina is not a good source of B12. A lot of the B12, there's a lot of molecules that are very similar to B12, and they can show up on B12 assays. They measure B12 in a food, but they're not active for humans. And so, unfortunately, a lot of companies claim that their products have B12, when in fact it's not active B12. So you shouldn't rely on spirulina. No natural sources of B12 should you rely on, because they might be more inactive analog than true B12.
Okay, that's good to know. Now, what about protein? This is another question we get asked a lot. Is there a risk of not getting enough protein on a vegan diet?
It's a very slim, it's a slim chance you're not going to get enough protein on a vegan diet. But if you're someone who avoids all salt foods, all meat substitutes, all legumes, or mostly avoids them, then it is possible that you could become, you might not be getting quite enough protein. Now, it's not going to result in actual full-blown protein deficiency, which is called kwashiorkor and results in edema, and it's a real serious disease. But you might have mild protein deficiency, and that could result in getting colds more often because of reduced immunity. Or it could, over the long term, possibly be harmful to bone health if you are chronically not getting enough protein. So for people who don't eat those foods that I mentioned, and they're all basically legume products, which includes peanuts, beans, peas, lentils, and soy foods, tofu, tempeh, and other meat soy foods. If those are good sources of the amino acid lysine, and they're really the only good vegan sources of that amino acid. So you need to be eating those, or possibly take protein powder if you don't eat any of those foods. Mm-hmm. Now, most vegans do naturally eat plenty of those foods, and so there's no problem.
Right. Now, is there a quality difference between plant proteins and animal proteins?
I would say there is, but practically it doesn't make a big difference.
Okay.
So, like I just mentioned, lysine is low in most vegan foods except for legumes. So if you're not eating legumes, then you're going to have a lower quality protein intake than if you were eating animal products, which do contain plenty of lysine.
Okay.
So, yeah, but for most people, it's not going to matter, because you don't need the exact right proportion of amino acids in every food you eat. Your liver basically pulls all the amino acids and then uses them as necessary in building proteins. So technically animal protein quality tends to be higher for most of the foods, but it doesn't matter, because you make up for it by just eating a variety of protein sources in a vegan diet.
Okay, that sounds good. Now, I often hear people say this, and I'm sure you do too. They say, I can't go vegan because my body just craves protein when I don't eat animal products. And I'm always stumped by this one, because it's something that I've never personally experienced before, and I don't really understand how anyone would know that their body is craving a specific nutrient. Can you explain this phenomenon? Do people really crave protein?
Well, that's hard to say whether these people are really craving protein. From my own experience, when I became vegan, and, you know, in the first couple of weeks, I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't know what to eat. I didn't know any good sources of protein. And so until I learned that, which took, like I said, a couple of weeks, I actually was also craving animal foods myself. But as soon as I was able to eat enough protein, that stopped. And I also think that the people think that meat synonymous with protein, but it's also fairly synonymous with fat. I mean, there's as much fat as protein in meat. And I think people might just be craving high caloric foods. You know, they're hungry, and so that's what they're craving. So I'm not sure that these people are really honing in on the exact need for protein in their body, that they happen to not get quite as many grams of protein that day as they think they should. I mean, as they actually need to stay in nitrogen balance. But you know, it is possible that if someone is not eating enough protein over a number of days, that they could start craving it, as well as fat and carbohydrates. People crave all three of those. And in some cases, people crave iron. People with iron deficiency anemia sometimes crave very odd foods, and there's a theory that a lot of that is due to iron deficiency. Okay. And so if someone is anemic, they may be craving the iron from meat. I think that's a possibility. Now, there's been no research to actually show that to be true.
Okay.
There has been research that's shown that people's cravings for these strange foods, it's called pica, is this disease where you start craving strange foods, iron deficiency, that will go away for some people if you cure their anemia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible that people are craving that. I'm not so sure, though, and in a lot of cases, it's really what's going on.
Okay, that's really good to know because I hear it quite a lot. What word of advice would you have for people who are athletes training on a vegan diet?
Right. I think that it really depends on what kind of athlete you are. Generally, if you're eating enough calories to maintain your body weight, you should be getting enough protein and other nutrients along with it. From just naturally the food you're choosing. So there's not a whole lot to pay attention to. Now, if you are a very high elite athlete and you are thinking about going vegetarian or vegan and say you're a power athlete or a sprinter or something like that, then you might consider taking creatine supplements, which have been shown to help vegetarian athletes. But again, for your average recreational athlete, it's not going to make any difference and it's not necessary. There are some articles on vegan sports nutrition on veganhealth.org, which is the website I maintain for vegan outreach.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're an athlete really interested in the details of sports nutrition for vegans, there's articles linked to there.
That's great. Okay, a friend of mine heard that you're going to be on the show, and she has a question for you. And her question is that she's a new mom, and she says, my five-month-old is not sitting up yet. He is not considered to be very behind, but most babies his age are sitting up. His muscle tone is floppy compared to most babies his age, so my doctor said to up the protein and amino acids. What are your thoughts?
Well, first, I don't understand if the doctor is saying she should up it in her diet. Is she breastfeeding or is
she's
she giving the baby formula?
Yes. She's breastfeeding.
And so the doctor is saying that she should up it
her protein.
In her diet?
Yeah.
You know, I don't really know. I'm not much of an expert on nutrition for infants.
Okay.
But I'd be happy to put her in touch with people who are.
That would be great.
Because there are other dietitians that might be able to help her out with that.
That would be great, because I don't think most doctors are very supportive about a vegan nursing mom.
Right. Unfortunately, a lot of doctors are not supportive of it, so that can be hard.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm happy to put her in touch with people who are.
Awesome. Now, what are some of the vegan staples that should be in the kitchen of every vegan to ensure proper nutrition?
Well, like I mentioned, legume products should be in each vegan's diet, and preferably some at every meal. Now, the other things that vegans need to pay attention to are more micronutrients. They can be gotten in a variety of ways. So we mentioned vitamin B12.
Mm-hmm.
Also, omega-3s are something that vegans should pay attention to, and you can get those in a variety of ways. One is just taking a supplement of DHA or EPA, which are omega-3 fatty acids. But your body also can make omega-3s from other foods. Your body can make the DHA and EPA from other omega-3 fatty acids, which are contained in walnuts, flaxseed oil, canola oil, hemp oil, and other less common oils. So if vegans should make sure they're getting some sort of source of omega-3s.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more information about that at veganhealth.org as well. In fact, I have a list of all the recommendations I make for vegans that vegans should check out and make sure they're taken care of. Then calcium is another one. I recommend that vegans get at least 700 milligrams of calcium, and most vegans won't get that just from their normal food choices.
Mm.
So one way to get the calcium is through fortified soy milk. Now, if you're someone who like soy milk and wants to drink it, soy milk is often fortified with calcium, vitamin D, omega-3s, and B12, depending on which brand you choose. So that can be a good way to get a lot of these nutrients that are a concern.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to calcium, there's also vitamin D. if you don't get much sunlight during the day, when sunburn is possible, then you need to think about a vitamin D supplement. And this is true for everyone, not just vegans. Now, cow's milk is generally fortified with vitamin D in the U.S. I'm not sure if it is in Canada.
It is in Canada as well.
It is? Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's how a lot of non-vegans get their vitamin D, but it's pretty small amounts even so. And new research is indicating that people need a lot more vitamin D than they would get from drinking a cup of cow's milk a day. So this is something that's a concern for everyone these days. I think it's become much more of a problem in the last decade because we are so used to putting sunscreen on whenever we're in the sun.
Right.
And so people aren't getting as much vitamin D. Then iodine is another thing that vegans have to think about, and it's really the last micronutrient of major, you know, concern. Iodine is often in dairy because they clean dairy equipment and cow's teats with iodine, and so it just ends up in the milk, and also in seafood and seaweed. So if you're a vegan who eats seaweed regularly, you're probably getting plenty of iodine. But if you don't, you should think about getting 75 to 150 micrograms of iodine every few days. And what I do is I just keep a bottle of iodine kelp supplements, and every few days I take one. So then the other thing is vitamin A. Vitamin A is pretty easy to get through a balanced vegan diet because it's in a lot of orange foods as well as some green leafy vegetables. But it's something that some vegans I can see not getting enough of because they don't actually eat much of that. And the easiest way to get it is a carrot juice. A half a cup of carrot juice should cover your needs each day. But it's also in kale, butternut squash, sweet potato, spinach, and just regular carrots, not the juice, and cantaloupe. Those are other good sources. And that's about it, I think, in terms of what every vegan should be paying attention to. You know, I eating whole grains for 2 to 3 servings a day is a good idea. Of course, eating fruits and vegetables and nuts are also good ideas. You should eat those every day as well.
That's a whole lot. I hope people are taking notes out there while they're listening. Now,
I have it all on one page on veganhealth.org. In the sidebar, there's something that says recommendations, and if you just click on that, everything I just talked about is right there.
Awesome. We only have about a minute and a half left, and I'd just like you to settle a debate for us. You mentioned soy foods a lot, and we always get angry phone calls from listeners when we talk about soy. So can you tell us, does soy give you man boobs? That's the question we get.
There's no evidence that soy gives you man boobs. And, you know, what people call estrogens in soy, it's not actually estrogen. It's a chemical somewhat similar to estrogen that can attach to estrogen receptors. But in most cases, it actually dilutes the effect of natural estrogen. Everybody's bodies make estrogen, even men make estrogen. And cow's milk has estrogen in it also. I mean, it has real estrogen in it and a lot higher. Some cow's milk has quite a bit of real estrogen and others doesn't, depending on whether the cow was pregnant when milked. But even that amount of estrogen in cow's milk is not thought to be, you know, it's not nearly the amount that you produce in your body anyway. So soy is definitely a concern for man boobs. and if it is, then dairy is more of one.
Dairy is more of one that can give you man boobs. Great.
Right. But it probably, I mean, neither one really does.
Right. Now, from your point of view, if you can take an average vegan, compare that person's health to an average meat eater, what are some of the differences you would observe?
So vegans are going to have lower cholesterol levels by quite a bit, by about 40 points. I think the average meat eater is about 202, and then the average vegan will be about 160. That's in the studies that have compared meat eaters to vegans I'm going by. And they tend to be fairly healthy meat eaters. So the average meat eater's cholesterol might be a bit higher than 200, 202. So then vegans will have lower triglycerides, a lower total cholesterol to HDL ratio, which is good to have it lower. Mm-hmm. Vegans generally have lower blood pressure, lower body weight, lower body fat percentage. Let's see if I'm thinking of, I think that, and lower rates of type 2 diabetes. Mm-hmm. So vegans have lower rates of all that. Now, if they're not taking B12, vegans will have higher levels of homocysteine, which isn't good.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's easy to take care of.
Right.
So those are the main differences that have been studied,
So despite all the deficiencies we've been talking about with a vegan diet, it's still much better to be on a vegan diet than a meat-centric diet.
Yeah, I mean, if you eat a standard American diet, I would definitely agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
If you are, you know, someone can eat real small amounts of meat, and I don't think that it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But, if you're talking about your average omnivore, I agree.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jack. And
you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye. To learn more about Jack Norris and vegan nutrition, please visit jacknorrisrd.com or veganhealth.com, as he has mentioned before. And we are at 12:30 and on to Animal Voices News.
All right. The National Marine Fisheries Service in the U.S. released findings many years in the making early in August that identify the protective measures necessary to ensure the survival of the Steller sea lion, which is the world's largest of the species. Their draft biological opinion found commercial fishing to be the most likely cause of population declines among sea lions in the western Aleutian Islands located near Alaska, as well as the failure of sea lion populations to rebound in other areas. Fishing fleets are catching too many of the fish that the sea lions are dependent upon for survival. Four BC municipalities are set to put forth resolutions to the Union of BC Municipalities in Whistler later this month in asking for assistance with dealing with wildlife populations they deem to be out of control, citing risks to public health and safety. Grand Forks and Kimberley are concerned with deer populations, some of which are said to be showing aggressive behavior, such as chasing dogs and harassing humans, while Saanich and Osoyoos are seeking help to control Canadian geese populations. According to Grand Forks Mayor Brian Taylor, residents are split on the issue, with some adamant that no deer be killed, while others feel the situation has become intolerable. In Kimberley, the feeling is that culling is ethically unacceptable to many citizens and potentially dangerous, recommending instead that the province financially assist municipalities in finding a practical, humane, contraceptive, or other method to reduce deer populations. Environment Minister Barry Penner said of the deer issue that while the province has made amendments to the Wildlife Act restricting the feeding of wild animals, further steps may have to be taken, such as fencing off certain areas and planting non-edible vegetation, as he's noted that deer seem to be taking refuge in urban areas where they are offered greater safety from predators such as cougars, wolves, and hunters. Penner also suggested that a possible solution may be for local governments to exercise their right to introduce the practice of bow hunting within urban areas to decrease population sizes. The overpopulation of Canada geese has led Saanich to urge the Union of BC Municipalities to petition the federal government and the Canadian Wildlife Service to make changes to the Migratory Birds Convention Act in order to allow municipalities to deal with overpopulation. Saanich claims that the birds are posing health threats at local lakes, beaches, parks, and playing fields, as well as having detrimental effects on the economy, tourism, and health. I was thinking that perhaps municipalities could take the responsibility themselves and maybe start fining people who are feeding geese or deer and encouraging the animals to encroach upon urban areas, which might generate the funds to provide revenue to enforce such things. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I wasn't really listening, but I think it's great. You know what? I'll listen to the podcast later and I'll give you my opinion then. So you are listening to the Animal Voices radio show at 102.7 FM CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. And remember to check out our website at animalvoices.org. We do have an interview coming up, but we're going to play a song first.
Once upon a time, in a nursery rhyme, there were three bears.
One, two, three.
One was a papa bear, one was a mama bear, one was a wee bear. They all went out a-walking in the woods, they were talking, when along came a little girl with long golden curly hair. You know who she was? Yeah. Her name was Goldilocks. Up on the door she knocked. Knock again, Goldie. Well, no one was there.
Yeah, no one was there, so she walked right in, had herself a ball. Cause she didn't care, no one was there. Soon she got sleepy, went to bed upstairs. Home, home, home came those three bears. Someone's been eating my porridge, said the papa bear, said the papa bear. Someone's been eating my porridge too, said the mama bear, said the mama bear. Eat papa wee bear,
said the little wee bear.
Someone's eating my porridge all up. Someone's been sitting in my chair. I said the papa bear, I said the papa bear. Someone's been sitting in my chair too. I said the mama bear, I said the mama bear. Wee papa wee bear,
said the little wee bear.
Someone's broken my chair. Someone's been sleeping in my bed. I said the papa bear, I said the papa bear. Someone's been sleeping in my bed too. I said the mama bear, I said the mama bear. Bee baba ree bear,
said the little wee bear.
Someone's been sleeping in my bed too. And here she is.
Joining us now is Sheila Begg, Director of Business Development of the organization Hug a Bull. Based in BC, Hug a Bull is a network of rescuers, adopters, and supporters of the pit bull breed. Welcome to Animal Voices, Sheila.
Thank you, Joanne. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. Can you tell us a little bit about Hug a Bull?
Sure, yeah. Hug a Bull actually started back in 2003 with a couple of women. Realizing that this breed needed a voice, and so they started their work in just working with local shelters, pulling one dog, getting it into foster care, and then eventually finding its permanent breed responsible home, and it kind of took off from there. And in 2004, they launched a website, and they never looked back. And since then, we've become an advocate for the breed. We're always constantly working on education, and we have quite a support community for other pit bull owners.
Mm-hmm. And why does your organization choose to utilize foster homes rather than operating a shelter?
Well, the main cost is money. Mm-hmm. Huggable is 100% volunteer-based, mm-hmm. So we all have families and full-time jobs, so we do Huggable in addition to that, and we run on private donations from the community. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the number. I mean, we'd love to have a shelter. That would be ideal. Mm-hmm. But we also feel that foster care is so critical in the adoption process. It allows these dogs to come out of the shelter to de-stress, to live in a home environment. Our foster homes are an extension of our assessment, so mm-hmm. we get to see what these dogs are like in home life as opposed to, just in the shelter life, because obviously there's lots of stressors there.
Mm-hmm. So it's probably much better outside of the shelter and in the home.
Absolutely, and ultimately, it ultimately helps in their adoption chances, right? Where people are able to meet these dogs that have been in a home, and see how they interact with family members and that sort of thing. So it certainly improves their adoption chances as opposed to coming right out of a shelter.
And how does someone get involved with your foster program?
We actually, on our website, we have a foster home application. It just asks a few questions about what dogs would be suitable, whether male, female, if you have cats, you have other pets, that sort of thing. And we do have a program coordinator who will contact interested parties and just talk a little bit more about the program, some more details. And we usually do a home check. We want to make sure you've got a home that's suitable for a dog. Mm-hmm. And we go from there, and then we often will work to find a dog that's currently in the shelter system that we can put into that foster home right away. Sometimes it takes a little longer, but when we have the foster home available, we certainly are active at finding a dog as soon as possible.
Now, I think a lot of people only know about pit bulls from what they hear in the media, and usually pit bulls are portrayed as aggressive dogs. Why do you think that of all the breeds of dogs, pit bulls have the reputation of being aggressive?
I mean, I'll be completely honest, obviously. I think media has a lot to do with that. I think over the years, media has realized that pit bull headlines sell, and therefore a lot of the dog incidences or dog attacks sort of thing are very much sensationalized in the media. And of course, what ends up happening is people read the headlines and just make their own conclusions of these dogs being inherently aggressive and dangerous. Unfortunately, there's a lot of fact that's missing from those stories. And, I mean, to be honest, you know, these dogs are getting into the wrong hands. And, you know, the small population of those that are choosing to exploit and abuse this breed are what is making the headlines. You know, and...
I've certainly seen a lot of aggressive dogs that are not pit bulls. Even like a standard-sized poodle has some pretty big teeth that they can bite pretty hard.
Yeah, and you know any dog is capable of aggression. It's not breed specific by any means.
I learned recently that a long time ago pit bulls were known as nanny dogs. Can you tell us why they were called that?
Yeah, absolutely. Back in the UK, United Kingdom is actually where that term was coined. They, because of their innate love of people and incredible tolerance of human behavior, they were often left with children as babysitters. We were never worried about, I mean, not that the parents would leave and, you know, leave their children alone, but there wasn't this constant supervision of children and dog because these dogs were so tolerant of ear tugs and, or tail pulls and ear pokes and eyeball pokes. And, you know, they were just so calm and so patient with children that they were given this term of nanny dog because they were just so wonderful with kids.
That's certainly something that I don't expect to hear because I think about, you know, if I were to adopt a pit bull, an ideal home probably wouldn't have kids or smaller pets. Are pit bulls good around children and pets?
Absolutely. They should definitely be good around children. The true temperament of a pit bull is one that loves all people. And if you come across a pit bull that's leery or aggressive towards humans, they unfortunately aren't displaying a true temperament of the breed. Are they good with other pets? They certainly can be. They can certainly live quite happily with other dogs, resident dogs. They can live with cats and other animals. I've seen pit bulls live with rats and different kinds of rodents and snakes and lizards. So, I mean, they can definitely live quite happily with other animals and most definitely with children. They make wonderful family dogs, actually, which is, I think, a big misperception.
Right, exactly. Now, like you said, the pit bulls usually are very kind to humans, but we hear about in the media that they're aggressive, they bite people. Is it because that maybe pit bulls are abused more than any other kinds of dogs?
Absolutely. I think a lot of what we hear in the media, though, is, unfortunately, part of their history and part of their breeding has been to be aggressive towards other animals. You know, as humans, we created that, and, you know, that's what we bred them for. And I think there's a big misperception regarding human aggression and dog aggression, and they don't equate to each other. So when we hear about a pit bull incident or what is being reported as a pit bull incident with another dog, people automatically assume that that means it's a dog that's aggressive with people as well.
Right.
And they're two very different things. And unfortunately, that's never communicated through the headlines or through the media. And, you know, that's what we work really hard to help people understand, is that dog aggression does not mean human aggression.
If there's one thing you want people to know about pit bulls, what would that be?
They love people. They do. Yeah, you know, I mean, the one question definitely is, you know, when you say one thing that I want people to know, if there's only one thing, that is definitely it, is that they really should love people. They make horrible guard dogs. You know, a lot of people think that it would be great to get a pit bull as a guard dog. No way. They'd let everybody in the house as long as you were paying attention to them. It's very true. And, you know, if you're coming across a pit bull that isn't like that, then unfortunately they're not true to their true breed or their true temperament.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now tell us a very special pit bull named Tiger.
Yeah, Tiger unfortunately had a horrible incident of abuse. From what we know, the details, he was lit on fire by someone, either his owner or someone that had gotten hold of him, and suffered third-degree burns over 30% of his body. He was taken in by the SPCA and treated for his medical needs, which was wonderful. Unfortunately, being in the shelter system and trying to heal from such severe injuries, it's difficult for any dog, and we contacted the SPCA and let them know that we were able to secure a foster home where he could, you know, finish his recovery and whatnot, and they released him to us. And what's been so remarkable about Tiger is that in spite of all the abuse and neglect that he did suffer, he's still wonderfully tolerant of people and loves everybody he meets. He was adopted into a wonderful family home on Vancouver Island, and he lives a life of luxury. You know, he sleeps on Italian rugs and, you know, lounges on the couches, and, you know, and he's a true testament to the absolute resiliency of this breed.
And that's just remarkable, because you would think that when a pit bull is abused like that, they would be, you know, aggressive, as the media would like us to believe. But even then, he still loves people.
Yeah, and that is the solid breeding of the breed. They were bred years ago to be tolerant of people because of the nature of what they were used for. When they were put in the fight rings with other animals or other dogs, their handlers or people were in the rings with them, and if there was any aggression shown towards the people, they were immediately called. It was an undesirable trait and was eradicated immediately. So they were bred to be extremely tolerant in spite of the abuse that they nowadays suffer, and seem to suffer more than any other breed.
And maybe that's why the gangsters, people that fight dogs, use them, because they're actually good with the people that handle them.
Absolutely.
Never thought of that before.
Yeah.
In 2005, Ontario legislated a ban on pit bulls. The legislation says that pit bulls born after a certain date must be euthanized in the interest of public safety, and those born before the date can live out their natural lives so long as they wear muzzles in public. Can you tell us what your thoughts are regarding the pit bull ban in Ontario?
Unfortunately, it doesn't work. If we look at the statistics currently in Ontario, dog bites and attacks and whatnot have not changed. Breed-specific legislation has shown time and time and again that it's ineffective. Many countries have actually repealed breed bans because they're seeing that it's not working, so they're looking at alternatives. You know, the people that have the dogs that are being inappropriate and attacking and biting are still going to own these dogs, and they simply go underground. You know, they're not going to heed our laws to say that they can't own the breed. It now just becomes a criminal activity. Really, breed-specific legislation only affects people like myself, who are responsible, who make sure my dogs are on leash and under my control and, you know, well-behaved in public and are trained and well-socialized and taken care of. And it's showing time and time again that breed-specific legislation simply doesn't work.
From what I understand, Ontario police can just remove people's loving companions from their homes and have them euthanized, and it wouldn't even matter if the dog might be the world's sweetest dog. He or she just has to be identified as a pit bull. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's simply showing the physical characteristics of a pit bull, so it is completely up to the discretion of the animal control officer. We have seen stories upon stories of different breeds of dogs, simply because they have short hair and a square head, have been mis-ID'd as a pit bull, when in fact they were a mastiff, or they were a boxer, or they were some other breed, and they're suffering because of BSL as well. Breed-specific legislation is really quite erroneous. There is no way of telling the true breed of a dog, unless you actually have registration papers and a long line of breeding. You know, so
if you adopted your pet, you will never be able to prove that your pet is not a pit bull.
No, and I mean, there are companies now that do DNA testing, but even that is so early. It's just something that's so new. There's over 400 breeds of dogs, and from what I understand, they only have about 140 in their database.
Right.
So even that is questionable in terms of DNA testing. So.
And what, in your opinion, is a better way to curb aggressive dog bites as opposed to breed-specific legislature?
We need to look at dangerous dog legislation. So, again, you know, we have a catchphrase that says punish the deed, not the breed. It's very true. You know, we need to look at owner accountability. We need to hold owners accountable for the actions of their dogs. We see time and time and again dogs being put in situations that get them into trouble with no consequence to their owners. And that needs to change. The city of Calgary has implemented some wonderful legislation and bylaws and has reduced their dog bites and attacks by 75%.
Wow.
Their licensing is up to 95%, where most cities are around 20.
Wow.
And Bill Bruce is actually coming into town. He's the director of animal services and bylaws in the city of Calgary, and he's being hosted by Huggable next week.
Great.
To speak to our lawmakers and our city officials and our shelter managers to talk about what he's been able to do for the city of Calgary, and hopefully, you know, pass on some ideas and you know, some legislation that works, and hopefully we can follow suit.
We'll definitely be following up on that story.
Please do. You'll probably see a media advisory come
out. Awesome. And we'll report on it. Now, if someone wants to adopt a pit bull, now that they find out what sweet animals they are, how do they do so from Huggable?
Get on our website. We often list all the dogs that we have available for adoption, both on Pet Finder and our website. We have an application form. It's quite lengthy, but it allows us to really get a lot of the preliminary information out of the way. Once we receive the application, we'll contact you and talk to you a little bit more about your needs and what you're looking for and what dog would best be suited. We then follow through with a home check, meet and greet of the dog. We'll sometimes, in some cases, do reference checks with veterinarians and whatnot. And when you meet your dog and it all goes well, then we finalize adoption papers and go from there. And one thing with Huggable is that we do believe in being a support for the lifetime of the dog. So once the dog is with you and out of our care, you know, our support continues with our online resources and our forum, and we have community events and whatnot.
That's great. And what is that website again?
Our website is www.hugabull.com.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Sheila.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
That was a really interesting interview. I learned a lot.
Yeah.
You are listening to the Animal Voices radio show here on 102.7 FM CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia. Remember to check out our website, animalvoices.org. And next week, we're going to be on vacation, or at least some of us will be.
Allison will be.
And Carissa.
So I'll be here.
So we'll be rerunning a past show that features an interview with Ethan Smith, who is the author of one of the best animal advocacy resource books available and winner of the 2008 Silver Nautilus Award, Building an Ark, 101 Solutions to Animal Suffering is the name of the book. Ethan will be sharing with us some of his 101 solutions that he presents in the book, including solutions to overfishing, protecting the orcas, finding your own niche in working for the animals, and working on a global scale to change society's mindset towards our treatment of animals and to nurture a reverence for all life. So that's coming up next week. Remember to find us on Facebook. Animal Voices Vancouver is our Facebook group, Twitter, Animal Voices YVR, and our email address if you want to send us any comments or suggestions or any events or anything, radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.
All right, see you in 2 weeks.
Bye. L'autorino, c'est Ross.
Et terrible, émission.
Émission.
Et terrible, émission.
L'autorino.
Je n'irai pas, maman. Le bruit.
Maman, je n'irai pas. Non, je n'irai pas. Je n'irai pas, maman.